You know what, Kyle? I've just really enjoyed hanging out with you the last couple of weeks. I feel like I've made a really special friend.
I know, right? We have so many of the same interests.
It's more than that, though. Like, we see the world in the same way.
It's so rare to find another person who does.
Well, we have a whole 3-day weekend in front of us. What do you feel like doing?
Oh, you pick.
No, you pick.
Well, it really doesn't matter because we'd probably pick the same thing. We're so similar.
That's true. Okay. Tell you what, let's count to three, and then at three, we'll say what we want to do at the same time.
And see if it's the same? I was going to suggest this.
Okay, ready? One,
One, two,
two,
three.
three.
Have
Go
sex
bowling
and
and
get
then get
married.
pizza. Whoa. This is awkward.
I totally read the situation the wrong way.
No, this is my fault.
How is it your fault?
I'm not sure exactly, but
Look, forget I said that thing.
about sex and getting married?
Right. Let's just go back to the way things were, just enjoying each other's company. We always have so much to talk about.
Yeah, we can't go back to the way it was.
It's ruined forever.
You know what I'm gonna have to do?
You have to kill me.
See, it's still amazing how our thoughts run in exactly the same direction.
I get it. I really do.
All right, well, I'm sorry that things got so awkward.
Me too.
Hey, audience, I think it would also be awkward if I murder Kyle in front of you. So, could you just listen to this show while I handle this? And now, the guy who said, "Any thoughts about dinner at the Donner Pass?" Colin McEnroe.
Is it too late to change mine to Chinese food and mini golf?
You still crack me up, Kyle. But no, seriously, you have to die.
All right, so that's one of the things that can happen when things get awkward. People almost feel as though their relation. I'll tell you a really quick story. I think I've told it once before, but I'll bring it up with our guest here. First of all, let me just I gotta back up and start all over again. First of all, let me say that rarely in the history of our show have we spent so much time sitting around the newsroom having these kind of Socratic dialogues about the topic. Like, what is awkwardness? How is it distinct from embarrassment? How is it distinct? How within the kingdom of awkwardness are there these principalities of awkward moments that would be awkward to any two people, or awkward moments that are conditioned by certain social norms that the two people don't share? Are there people who are more vulnerable to awkward moments? And I can absolutely guarantee you that I am that kind of person that I there are people who create awkward moments, and then there are people who are so at pains to avoid awkward moments that it becomes a kind of pathology. I am that latter kind of person. I truly believe that if I were in a restaurant choking to death, I would go and hide in a corner and choke to death rather than having the awkward problem of asking someone to help me and calling attention to myself. And then having the Heimlich maneuver. And I mean, I just all those the social norms are just piling up at the door like a snowdrift, and I can't get that door open. So anyway, we have a lot of stuff to talk about today. Awkwardness can be a very powerful thing. It's an important thing to talk about. It can be a dangerous thing too. Here in the fictional world of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you hear the villain explain to one of the heroes exactly how dangerous awkwardness can be.
This takes discipline. It's a science of 1,000 details. The planning, the execution, it's the cleanup. I guess I don't have to tell you, but you're going to create quite a mess. Shh. Let me ask you something. Why don't people trust their instincts? They sense something is wrong. Someone is walking too close behind them. You knew something was wrong. You came back into the house. Did I force you? Did I drag you in? No. All I had to do was offer you a drink. It's hard to believe that fear of offending him is stronger than the fear of pain, but you know what? It is. And they always come willingly.
So joining us on that somber note is Tai Toshiro, a psychiatrist and the author of two books, most recently Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. You can learn more about that at awkwardbook.com or where else. So Tai Toshiro, we do have a kind of taxonomy to run through here, right? I mean, there are things, there are moments that would be awkward for anybody. And then there are people who process awkwardness differently. Tell us about those kinds of people.
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction to start with. So you have awkward moments, which we've all experienced ourselves, and you can think about probably tons from even the past week, if you're me. And then we have awkward people who experience a lot more awkward moments than the average person. But we actually know a lot now about the psychology of how their minds work differently in social situations and why they are more prone to being awkward on a consistent basis. But if we start with the awkward moments are simply deviations, usually small deviations, from social expectations. And if you think about any given social interaction that you're in, there's actually dozens, if not hundreds, of social expectations that you need to meet. You need to have dressed appropriately. You need to have bathed. You need to maintain the about 18 inches of personal space. You need to maintain eye contact for about 3.2 seconds at a time. If you break this down into the minutia of everything that happens in a social interaction, there's tons of places where you can slip up. And so it's totally understandable why even the most socially adept among us could have an awkward moment.
Right. So there's I think when we're talking about that, it's almost as if we all are walking around carrying these invisible playbooks or rule books. And what's imperative to avoid awkwardness is that they be the same playbooks and the same rule books, and we have read them with the same level of assiduousness. So, you know, awkward things happen if, in fact, your playbook is really different from mine, or if you don't know something really important about me. I'll tell you a really quick story, which I have told on this show a few months ago, so apologize to people who have heard it before. So a journalist I know, this is quite a long time ago, was doing some work way down in the deep south. He was renting one half of a duplex from the duplex's owner. She was a widow who kind of doted on him, having this nice young man in the other side of her duplex, and she would leave casseroles and things like that, or probably unhealthy southern food for him to eat. And everything went along swimmingly, except that one day when she was talking to him, she made a blatantly anti-Semitic remark. I mean, a significantly anti-Semitic remark. And his way of dealing this was to say, "Mrs. Bigelow, I feel like I should just tell you right now that I'm Jewish." At which point, she just turned around and walked away. She didn't say another word. And a couple of days passed in silence. And then he was approaching the house one day, hot summer evening, and one of the Arab-Israeli conflicts was unfolding on TV news. You know, one of the wars of the 60s, I think. And he could see the light of her TV, and she was watching her TV. And without turning to look at him, she just yelled through the screen door, "I hope them Jews whoop them Arabs." At which point, their relationship resumed. It was sort of as if nothing had happened. But some of the awkwardness of this tie is people didn't know certain things that were vital to know, right?
That's right. There was a miss of a key social cue here on the part of the host. And that's an interesting moment, because that teeters, you know, on something that really could have been very offensive. I'm sure it was on some level, but it was also uncomfortable. It was kind of in between those two things. It sounds like your friend was pretty gracious in that situation and patient about it.
Right. And also, they found a way to deal with it. You know, I mean, she said something of a conciliatory nature that was just enough to kind of jumpstart whatever kind of relationship they were having. But there are people, as you write, who don't even have maybe the arsenal that's needed to either get through a situation that's a little bit tricky. I mean, I feel like I'm one of those people. I would, you know, I flounder in situations where I'm called, where things might get awkward.
Yeah, I know. I'm the same way. So I resonate with you there. And yeah, there's some of us who we just have this instinct, right, that when we're going to be in a new social situation with a new set of social expectations, or maybe people we don't know very well, and so we suspect that we might not know the culture of that group or the social expectations, it creates more anxiety than it does for the average person. And, you know, I think some of that social anxiety is actually okay. And I think if someone's a little bit disposed to being socially awkward, that social anxiety at the right level can actually be motivating so that they think ahead to how do I want to handle this situation? And then in the moment, they're really motivated to be extra attentive to the cues in the room and extra attentive to thinking about what other people are trying to tell them and what their motives might be. So I think awkward people can oftentimes correct for some of the anxieties they have about their skill deficits when it comes to social situations.
One of the stories you tell about yourself in the book has to do with what Charlie Brown found to be a very awkward and anxiety-provoking situation, which is the strange tradition of Valentine's Day cards being handed out in classrooms. So even at a very young age, you understood a certain thing about yourself that came up in that situation.
That's right. You know, it was the standard fourth grade. Everybody gets those boxes of 30 Valentine's cards, and you write one to each of your classmates, and you put it in their designed brown paper bag, and it's a really nice, I think it's a really nice thing in hindsight. At the time, when I was in fourth grade, I got the box of cards. Well, first of all, it took a long time for me to get a box of cards. All the boxes of cards struck me as overly emotional. Because they said standard things for Valentine's Day, like I love you or love you lots, which is appropriate for Valentine's Day. I thought this was way overboard, so it took about 3 hours till I found the right box that was of the lowest emotional intensity possible. And then when I got home, it was just still too overwhelming for me. So I took my Sharpie and I crossed out words like love, replaced it with handwritten words like, took out some of the modifiers like lots or a lot, and sealed them up, delivered them to my classmates the next day. And it's just one of those moments where you don't realize until it's actually happening how awkward you've been in preparation. Mm-hmm. So as my class, I saw some of my classmates getting to my cards, and they had these very perplexed fourth grade looks on their faces about what I had done to edit them. And I learned a good lesson about myself, that my emotional wiring was probably pretty different than most kids.
Right. And awkward begets awkward. So you felt awkward about this situation. You created a different kind of awkward situation by trying to compensate for it in an awkward way. But, you know, when you say that about the wiring, it's not as though the thing we're talking about is anywhere in the DSM-4 or the DSM-5 or whatever DSM we're on right now, right? There isn't really a diagnosis.
That's right. And I think this is actually one of the more broadly interesting things about social awkwardness is that it says a lot about most of the diagnoses in the DSM, actually, which is that we think of diagnosis in psychology or psychiatry or in medicine as an either-or thing, right? You have a diagnosis or you don't. But in reality, most things fall along a bell curve in the general population, and awkwardness is no different. So what it's related to is autism and what they used to call Asperger's syndrome symptoms. So it's social skill deficits, communication problems, and this kind of obsessive interest in esoteric things. And if you look at population data, what you find is that the average person in the population actually has 3 or 4 autistic symptoms. And it's fine, and they deal okay with that. But when you get out to like the 80th, 90th percentile of that curve, that's where you start to get people who are socially awkward. And when you cross the 99th percentile, that's when you have someone who's diagnosable as a high-functioning autistic.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, as we've talked a lot about awkwardness, that one of the skill sets that can be important is the ability to talk in a non-weird way about what's happening. And so, I mean, it's sometimes in academia we call this metacognition, thinking about thinking. In psychiatric terminology, it's sometimes called primary process, right? You're just sort of kind of talking about exactly what's going through your head right now. But that could be useful, right? If you're in an awkward situation and everybody just falls silent, there's not much to be done. But if you can sort of say, hey, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong about this. right. If you can say, hey, here's what I think is going on right now, you know, and it's really kind of awkward. So, you know, I mean, in some ways, that's one of the ways you can get the ship back upright. Or am I wrong about that?
I think that's spot on, Colin. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of awkward people ask me, so if I do something awkward, what should I do? And my general advice is just to do exactly what you said. Just talk about what's happening, because everybody knows that it's happening. Yeah, that we sometimes have this wishful thinking that nobody noticed that we were so awkward, but of course everybody noticed, and we've noticed too. If we feel an appropriate amount of embarrassment, we're probably blushing, which signals to everybody that we know as well. And it's actually helpful in those cases to say, hey, I just did something awkward, and I realize that's a little weird, or I realize that's kind of funny, and then it's okay, you know? A lot of times people can have a good laugh about it then in the moment, instead of having to wait, you know, 2 weeks or 2 months until it's now funny much later after the embarrassment has subsided.
So the other thing is that the more fuzzy our social mores are, the more likely we are to have an awkward encounter. So, you know, my now deceased mother-in-law from a marriage that's also no longer intact was from the South and had this very highly evolved set of manners, Southern lady manners. So that not only do you know enough not to put your hand into the mashed turnips and like eat them off your fingers, you know what to do if somebody else does that. I guess it could be argued, I wouldn't necessarily argue this, but it could be argued that the more that mores and manners break down, the more we run into awkward stuff because the rule book thins out a little bit about how to deal with things.
Well, I totally agree with that. I think that, and I'm a fan, by the way, of the idea that people have more freedom to engage in a lot of different cultural beliefs and cultural worldviews. I think that's one of the great advances that we've made sociologically, is to allow for that. Obviously, we have a long ways to go, but we've made tremendous progress in those regards. But, you know, one of the things I'll say to groups when I'm working with them on something that's multicultural is I'll say, you can recruit people to come here who are of different cultures, and that's a really positive, great step. But that's when the work really starts. And now there becomes this semi-awkward series of encounters where you have to figure out what are the different expectations between people who have been raised in different cultural traditions. Part of the defining feature of a different culture is that they have a different set of expectations. And I think it's important for people to realize that usually across cultures, the purpose of these social expectations and manners is to facilitate and smooth the social interaction and to convey to other people that, hey, I'm invested in the group and I'm invested in the benefit of the larger good rather than just myself.
You know, we're going to talk in the final segment about culture, but and how this works in culture. But it's worth talking about it right now, too, that to whatever degree we become more heteronormative, to whatever degree we become more comfortable with diverse self-expressions. And as you've pointed out, you know, shows like The Big Bang Theory, in which, you know, nerdy characteristics, which are effectively defective social characteristics if you're in a real kind of leave it to beaver kind of normative environment, they're celebrated. So now the person who shows up at a party dressed as Chewbacca, you know, that could have been just a glaring, horrible, awkward mess. But it's not necessarily now, right? There's some understanding that maybe there's some differences worth celebrating.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the Chewbacca outfit still gets some awkward glances.
Well, at a funeral.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, before we go into that, I'll just say that's one of the great things about awkward people. I just love their enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. You know, like I like Star Wars, but I don't own a Chewbacca costume. I love the fact that you're walking through New York City and you see people dressed as Chewbacca or Darth Vader, whatever else, for the opening of the new Star Wars movie. That's a degree of commitment you usually don't see in other people. But yeah, I do think that's the case, that we have more range and we're allowed to be more expressive than we used to be. And I think there's a tension right now in our country, right, about some folks want to go back to the old days where things were more cut and dry and clear. And other folks say, hey, this is our great opportunity to shake things up and create something new and different. But I think as we do that, it's really important to distinguish between when we have a moment with somebody that's just social discomfort versus a moment that's actually offensive or wrong. Those are two very different things. But I think sometimes we get those things confused and we feel uncomfortable, and the anxiety of that discomfort kind of makes us lash out with a judgy comment, right? Or a judgy perspective about the differences between us and somebody else.
All right, we're going to take a little break here. Ty's going to come back as we go out. Hey, Betsy, you know that Boba Fett costume in my office? Could you just move that? That's not my costume. I don't know why people think that that's my costume. All right, we're going to take a little break, and we'll come back after this.
Such a feeling is not heard in my circle when it's awkward. Situation is absurd, irregular and awkward. Such a feeling is not heard.
I was expecting my second daughter and working for a magazine. One day, waiting to see a city official, I made small talk with her secretary, who asked if we had chosen a name. I told her we were avoiding names that ended in an N, since our last name started with one. Someone had suggested Robin, I said, and not only do I hate the name Robin, but it ends in an N. She paused expectantly. I looked down at the nameplate on her desk, and it read, Robin something. I was so mortified I could not even manage a just kidding, and I wished the floor would swallow me up.
All right, I think that works as an awkward moment. We ask people to call in and leave voice messages, and we usually have a pretty good success rate with this, but that was like the only one. I think part of the problem with awkward moments is that they are so troubling. They are so toxic in our soul. If we haven't dealt with them yet, they're still bothering us 10 years later. People don't like talking about them. If they do like talking to them, or if they have to talk about them, they talk to Ty Toshiro, psychiatrist and author of two books, most recently Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. They also might decide to write to Jennifer Pepys, a writer, director, film instructor in Chicago. She's the founder of Captain Awkward, a blog about how to deal with awkwardness. Jennifer, welcome to our show.
Hello.
Did I awkwardly mispronounce your last name?
No, you said it correctly. It's
all right.
Pepys.
Okay.
So you can imagine elementary school for me.
Right. Or just even well-meaning people who just somehow or other feel like they should say it differently. Even in adult life. So, Jennifer, I'm just going to ask you about the kinds of things that people... Well, actually, let me just begin by saying, how did you become possibly the self-appointed Tsarina of the land of the awkward? How did you get to... Who promoted you to Captain Awkward?
It's a list military title.
Yeah.
I claimed it for myself. I started the blog in 2011, just basically because I was kind of addicted to advice columns.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way that they are storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
That you get to sort of, that people send you a story and you get to read a story and then you get to kind of play with their story and rewrite their story. And it's a lot, I still make movies and I love it, but it's a lot cheaper than indie filmmaking to write, blog posts.
Right. So let's take a typical thing, and I'll have both you and Ty work on this whole problem. So you've got, a thread going about why people apologize for something that was said, and done in the past, or whether this is a good idea, what the statute of limitations, is or are. So, Jennifer, lay that out for me. I mean, why would people even want to be asking you about that particular thing?
Well, I feel like it is, you know, we talk about staircase wit, l'esprit d'escalier, that like, yeah. I thought of the perfect thing to say days later on the staircase, French expression. But there's also that like, oh, I said the wrong thing, that kind of embarrassment that stays with us. And I think for a lot of people, it's anxiety, and a lot of people, it's just like, we want to be kind. And if we feel that we were accidentally unkind, we feel guilty. We want to fix it.
Right.
Does that answer the question?
Yes, it does. So, Ty, I'm going to turn it back over to you. So this is the kind of thing for, an awkward person that might create kind of a puzzle. The puzzle being, did I do something wrong? If I did something wrong, should I apologize for it? If I apologize for it, will I create a secondary awkward situation where, in fact, it turns out that this meant so much more to me than it did to the person to whom it happened in passing that I've further drawn a big A on my own forehead. So, Ty, maybe, first of all, as a psychiatrist, you can kind of work on that.
Yeah. Well, I go through that all the time myself. So, you know, that's a classic awkward set of cognition right there. A series of if-then statements strung one to the next. And they tend to be longer, I think, than the average person's. And yeah, you can overthink it sometimes. And then you end up coming back totally well-meaning, trying to apologize for something you said. And the person looks at you weird and says, oh, that was nothing. That was no big deal. But that's not a bad outcome, necessarily. That's a pretty neutral outcome. If you take the other possibility, which is that you did say something that was offensive or hurtful, it's really good to, you know, err on that side of being cautious and go back and say something. It's kind of like blushing, like delayed blushing in some ways. And the really interesting studies about blushing find that people who blush are much more likable and much more trustworthy than people who don't blush a lot. It's our way of signaling instinctively to other people that, hey, I messed up and I'm really sorry. I'm going to try to not make that happen again.
Yeah. So, Jennifer, I'm not Captain Awkward. I'm not even Lieutenant or Sergeant Awkward. But it seems to me that if I were in your platoon, one thing that I'd be saying based on what Ty's saying is that the person who's wrestling with this question is already miles ahead of the person who's incapable of wrestling with this question, right? If you're asking yourself this question, that means you understand that you
right.
you can make mistakes, right?
Right. It's your Exactly. Like the fact that you're like thinking about other people and their reactions and you're thinking about your own actions and wanting to make sure that they live up to who you want to be, you're already showing that you're somewhat an ethical person who thinks about how to treat other people. So some of the beating ourselves up that we do is maybe not necessary. Actually, jerks will not agonize about the mean things they say after the fact. They'll just be like, I'm fine. So self-awareness is really nice.
Right. And, you know, Ty, as she's talking, Ty, I'm thinking of the Billy Joel song. So many of Billy Joel's lyrics have profound meaning for me. But there's a song called Big Shot, and it's basically this guy, probably Billy Joel, who's been out the night before, and now he's thinking of how he acted. And he's cringing over the way that he behaved. And I don't think that would necessarily fit the behavior of your awkward person, but the person who self-identifies as awkward, the more loosened up that person becomes, the more free that person becomes in a social situation, I would assume that raises the possibility of second-day regrets. Like, wow, I didn't keep the leash on myself. What in the world did I do?
Yeah, no, exactly, because they probably went further than they usually go with some of their social range and heightened the chances of mistakes. And I think the mistake in that situation is for the awkward person to think, I should never push myself beyond my comfort zone. It's not good advice in just about anything in life. But I think there can be that all or nothing thinking sometimes, which is, especially because awkward people really like routine and they really like order and method. When they go outside of that and there's a negative consequence, I think it can really set them back to a place that's a little bit too rigid for their own good.
And Jennifer, I'm also wondering, I mean, it seems to me that the internet is a kind of a double-edged sword. In a way, you get to practice a lot of social interactions on the internet in a pretty low-risk environment. So you may, under normal analog situations, only have 5 or 6 conversations over the course of a day, but you can have 100 conversations on the internet. The other problem is, of course, there's a jillion different social cues not available to you. So I don't know, is the internet making us into even more awkward people, or does it help at all?
Well, just to get back to something about awkward people liking routines and liking rules and liking things to maybe be predictable, that there's a lot of research that you can do about how to act. There's a site called like Succeed Socially that sort of breaks down really basic, like how to make small talk and how to introduce yourself. And I think there have always been these kind of like etiquette guides in the world that people could absorb the information. As to your point about I don't think the internet is making people more awkward. I mean, in-person interactions are real and online conversations are real. Like as soon as you have human beings communicating with each other through no matter the medium, those conversations are real, and the paying attention to manners and being kind and being thoughtful and listening and like all of those skills are still important. There's different ways of expressing it. And yes, some of the nonverbal cues are missing, but there's like online discussions still have their own sort of rules and manners in order to be productive. So I don't think that we can sort of say like, oh, the internet just made everyone awkward. Mm-hmm. I think the internet connected a lot of us awkwards with each other to be like, oh, it's not just you that's overthinking that.
Right, right. You can reality test some things there. You know, Ty, as we're talking, one of the things that I'm coming back to is that the word awkward, the adjective awkward, can be followed by any number of nouns. But I'm thinking the noun silence is probably the most frequent word paired up with awkward. And so why is that? In other words, you know, we said before that if you're able to use some metacognition or some primary process and kind of fill up that silence with some analysis of what's going on, that's great. But what is it about the silence? Maybe even somebody awkward walking into a room and joining a group of three people who are already talking and the conversation stops dead. What is it about that silence that's so incredibly deadly?
You know, I think that's one of the interesting things is as I was writing Awkward, I looked at some of the cross-cultural differences about how awkwardness manifests differently in different cultures. And some things we do here that we think are awkward are not awkward at all in other cultures and vice versa. I think, you know, Susan Cain has that great book, Quiet, where she talks about the culture of extroversion we have in the United States. And I agree with that. And a lot of the data supports that. We see extroversion as one of the most socially valued things out there. And so if there's a silence, this is a little signal that somebody is not being extroverted, or both people are not being extroverted, and that everybody's messing up kind of in the situation. But if you go to other countries where it's not so heavy in extroversion, you'll find that silences are totally fine and totally comfortable. And in fact, sometimes a way to show a sense of respect or comfort with other people.
Very quickly, because we're running out of time here, Jennifer Beepus, you know, we're the next segment, I'm going to be talking with a different guest about the celebrated New Yorker story, Cat Person. And at one point in this story, a young woman winds up having sex with a man mainly because expectations have built up in a certain way. And it would really be unbelievably awkward to change course at that point. She feels like the cost of that is higher than the cost of having sex she doesn't want. Is that a kind of story that you would recognize from people who write into Captain Awkward?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we need a whole nother show.
Right,
to
I think
talk
we would.
About
yeah.
Just all the ways that people, and especially women, are socialized to make things flow and be socially adept and not hurt any feelings, and especially not any man feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the whole like, oh, you got to let him down easy, and preferably like don't let him down at all. And so I can totally understand that.
It's
pressure.
It's the weaponization of awkwardness, which is something we're going to talk about in the third and final segment here. But right now, I want to thank our two guests, Ty Tashira, PhD, author of Awkward, the Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome, and Jennifer Peepus, who does the column Captain Awkward. If you've got awkward problems, write to Captain Awkward. She's there for you.
Today's show was produced by... This is awkward. Who's the woman?
She brushes her teeth all the time in the ladies' room, which is also a little awkward. Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish finds it awkward when one of her dates can't breathe underwater. The part of Bill Curry was played by George Costanza. On tomorrow's show, a look at the funny papers. And now, back to Colin.
So based on everything we've just said, it's hard to imagine in the abstract that awkward encounters and awkward moments and awkward people could constitute some basis for widespread mass entertainment. But actually, I think that really does happen. There's a tremendous amount of entertainment that is based on everything that we have just talked about in the first two segments. Just for example, many, many people tune in pretty, pretty often to listen to this particular guy.
Hey, what's all that? Look at all those gifts.
I thought you said that we weren't supposed to bring a present.
He said no gifts. I don't get it.
Hello?
Hey!
Hi, guys.
Let me ask you something. Did you guys bring a gift to this thing?
Of course.
Yeah.
See,
he said no gifts.
Nobody means that. You took that seriously. You don't...
Of course I did. Look at all these.
I know.
Oh, what do you got there? Chicken? Oh, yeah. Thank you.
I know. I'm fine. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. You brought something, right?
No, I didn't bring anything. He said no gifts, so I didn't bring anything.
Yeah, you're the only one.
All right, so that episode, by the way, of course, goes on to include a moment when Larry David, the person you hear talking, accidentally stabs the birthday guest Ben Stiller in the eye with the skewer that the chicken you just heard about was on. But there's already this kind of exploring of social awkwardness, the way you probe a sore tooth with a tongue. Here to talk to us about this is Megan Garber, who reports on culture for The Atlantic. She recently wrote a piece for The Atlantic called The Weaponization of Awkwardness. Megan Garber, welcome to our conversation.
Thanks so much. Glad to be with you.
Is there something new and special going on with characters like Larry David's Larry David or the two protagonists of The Office, the British and American versions? Or are they just extensions of a fascination with awkwardness that, you know, drifts back to Jack Benny or wherever you want to begin the conversation?
Sure. I think it's a little bit of both, actually. Benjamin Disraeli, back in the day, talked about awkwardness, and he said, it is civilization that makes us awkward. So there is something, I think, deeply profound about the human experience as relates to awkwardness. And I think the reason it has remained a subject of fascination through the years, you know, up through Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld and so many other comedians, is there's something so relatable about it. I mean, I relate very much to that Larry David scene, even though I've never had that particular experience. I've had so many, you know, similar experiences where I just think, oh, I did it wrong. I should not have done it that way. I think a lot of people are in the same boat. I also, though, think that there is something new about our fascination with awkwardness in the sense of we now have social media. We have a way of sort of quantifying and analyzing social interactions that we didn't quite have before. We can actually look at people having conversations on Facebook, on Twitter, et cetera, and sort of pinpoint the moment that awkwardness intrudes or sort of analyze how precisely that conversation was awkward. So I think awkwardness is very old, but it's also new in its way.
Yeah, I think maybe another thing that's new, tell me what you think of this, is awkwardness in the past may have existed in much more clearly stratified ways. So in Edwardian England, you know, everybody kind of knew the rules, right? They're just, no matter what social class you were at, you knew the rules. Whereas as a society becomes more pluralistic and class becomes at least theoretically more fluid, it seems to me that the work of Seinfeld and especially Larry David is essentially asking the question, what are the codes that aren't written down anywhere? What are the rules that either exist but nobody talks about them or should exist? What they're really exploring to a certain degree is a legitimate amount of confusion about what the rules of society are.
Oh, that's such a good point. And, you know, we talk about sort of social contracts in these broad and sweeping terms of politics and culture and society and all of that. But I think there's also, you know, the social contract that operates within the moment itself. You know, these, like you said, these unspoken rules that guide and help us navigate, you know, interactions with people we know very well and people we don't know well at all. And yeah, we are at a moment, I think, when those rules are being questioned a little bit and we're often unclear about what the rules actually entail, and awkwardness ensues.
So, Megan, I think another thing is, like, when we watch physical slapstick, you know, what's going on in our heads? Well, I mean, we know that Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton or whoever or Inspector Clouseau, they're not really in real life probably physically getting hurt, at least not the way that it looks on screen. And it's also something that we recognize as painful, but it's not happening to us. It's happening to a fictional character. So we laugh. We laugh because we can experience this thing, which is the thing that we dread. We really do dread somebody dropping a hammer on our head from three stories. And I wonder if the comedy of awkwardness is a little bit like that, too. You watch this happen to some other schlemiel who's not you, but you recognize the pain.
I think that's exactly right. I think, and there's something cathartic about that process where you think, well, if okay, it's happening to Larry David. So on some level, it's not happening to me, even though it kind of is. And yeah, you feel that awkwardness deep in your soul, if you are me. I mean, there are times that I actually have to turn off Curb Your Enthusiasm because the pain is too much. The awkwardness is too visceral and tangible for me. So I think that's a really good point.
Although I do think that Larry David and some of the people who are like him, they also represent a different thing, too, at least in terms of the violation of social convention, in the sense that Larry David, unlike you and me, is almost immune from the experience of awkwardness. So that, you know, if you or I watch somebody bite into a carrot and then re-dip it into the dip or something, we're just going to not eat the dip the rest of the night. We're going to walk away. We're going to deal with this in some very passive way. Whereas the Seinfelds and the Davids, what they do is they don't find it awkward to say, hey, don't do that.
Yeah, you dip the chip, you took a bite, you dipped again, all of that. We, the viewers, are sort of forced to experience it almost on their behalf, and they get to control the narrative. And I think one of the main things about awkwardness is kind of a loss of control. You, if you are experiencing a moment of awkwardness, either vicariously by watching these shows or within a social interaction, you lose control. You,
yes.
are sort of embarrassed in the sociological sense of like deviation from the norm. And it's that loss of control that I think makes it such a powerfully horrible feeling.
So I want to talk a little bit about a different kind of imperviousness. And so of the two iterations of The Office, I know the Ricky Gervais one better. I didn't see the Steve Carell one, but I'm assuming they're pretty similar to one another. And so Ricky Gervais's character, I think, has a different kind of imperviousness. And it really is one that anticipates the modern moment in an interesting way. He has an imperviousness that's somewhat based on his own dumbness and cluelessness, but it's also based on privilege to a certain degree. He has more power than anybody else, and he apparently has not felt obliged or been obliged to learn as many of the rules of social discourse, maybe because he's a white male office manager. You know, he can do things which absolutely everybody else recognizes as unbelievably awkward and huge personal violations, and it just washes over him.
I'm actually more familiar with the U.S. version of the awkwardness and can say that it's very much the same thing for Michael Scott. He sort of enjoys his own privilege without even realizing that it's privilege and inflicts it on everyone else in a way that is never malicious. That's the thing I think with these characters. It's never meant meanly or, violently in the social sense. It's just meant self-interestedly and you know, it's self-absorption, and everyone else in the social settings of these shows is having to absorb the awkwardness on behalf of these other characters.
Right. So let's hear Michael Scott, played by Steve Carell, publicly asking Carol Still, played by Nancy Walls, to marry him.
Ah, hi. Sorry, I just have an announcement to make. Okay, I have learned a lot about Indian culture tonight, but I have learned even more about love. And I know you're all thinking, who is this crazy gringo and what is he talking about? Well, I'm not crazy. Maybe I'm crazy in love. So, without further ado, Carol Stills, I would like you to do me the honor of making me your husband.
Oh, Michael.
What are you saying?
Can we talk about this in private?
I didn't hear you.
Can we talk about this in private?
Oh, you gotta be kidding.
Okay. Megan Garber, let's unpack this for a second. In a way, it seems as though, once again, to a certain degree, there's a little bit of privilege in here, too. This guy thinks he's holding a great hand, you know, that he's got a full house in his hand, you know, and in fact, he has junk cards in his hand, but somehow or other, he doesn't know it.
Yeah, he thinks he is being so sort of magnanimous by bringing everyone that he loves and that he knows into this proposal without actually having the sort of extra step of empathy to think, will Carol appreciate this proposal? Will she not? Will she say yes? Will she say no? He hasn't actually done the sort of emotional calculus of figuring out what her reaction would be, because of course he's Michael Scott and he does not think about the reactions of other people. He thinks only about himself.
So we can laugh at all this, and it is truly funny. I just last night discovered a show people have been telling me about for a long time called My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which is also very much built up around very, very awkward situations, and it's terrific, and it's hilarious, and it's wonderful. But there's a darkness to all this, too, and I think one of the things that you noticed in the now very celebrated New Yorker short story Cat Person is there's sort of a moment, like earlier in the show, I confessed that I have been in situations where I thought I was starting to choke to death, and my reaction was to go hide somewhere as opposed to publicly solicit the Heimlich maneuver, like in the middle of a restaurant or something, because that would just be so unbelievably awkward to have everybody looking at me while I got the Heimlich maneuver. Better to go into a dark corner and die. Well, there's a little of that in Cat Person, right? The female protagonist suddenly finds herself doing things, either riding in a car with a strange man or engaging in sex that she essentially doesn't want with a strange man, because the social elements of the structure have kind of mutated into a point where the awkwardness of changing course exceeds whatever she sees as the incredible downside of continuing.
Yes, exactly. And that was, to me, that was the most striking element of the story. There were many striking elements, but that was the most, just this idea that you would essentially give consent without wanting to, just because it's much more comfortable to do that than to say, no, actually, I've changed my mind. The writer Ella Dawson had a really good analysis of that story. And she said, you know, women have sex all the time, you know, not because they want to, but because it's just easier than saying no, because we condition young women to feel guilty if they change their mind. And that was such a powerful part of that story. And like you said, really does hint at the negative sides of awkwardness, because I think we can all agree that it's not a good situation when a woman is in a position of giving consent that she doesn't actually really want to give, just to avoid making a scene.
Right. And I think it does attest to the incredible powerfulness of these social norms. I mean, you could go back to the Milgram experiments and at least argue that the people in the Milgram experiments who periodically thought that they were effectively torturing another subject in the experiments and didn't, you know, break with the experimenter, didn't, you know, that the social power of the moment may have been part of the reason why they just didn't feel they could say to a guy in a white lab coat, you know, I'm really uncomfortable with what's happening here.
Right, exactly. And I think we are just so thoroughly conditioned to avoid making scenes, you know, to assert yourself over sort of the ethic of the moment. I think we've been told is not good. You know, you don't make a scene. Don't make it weird. Don't make it awkward. And even though there is sort of a golden age of awkwardness right now, I think throughout the 20th century, certainly, and beyond, you can see that sort of, you know, that the notion of awkwardness and the power of awkwardness has exerted itself.
Right. So, Megan Garber, we should land in a positive place or give people a takeaway. I think mine is, after reading your piece and then talking to you, too, is that maybe in a way everybody needs to discover a little bit of Larry David inside themselves. Everybody's in, because Larry David doesn't mind saying, he doesn't mind sort of making a scene or making it weird, as you say.
I think that's exactly right. And I think, too, the rise of social media has really promoted this ethic of the agency of the individual and the power of the individual story and experience. And in a lot of ways, that can fight against this sort of overarching, you know, mandate against making things awkward. So I think we are going to get a little bit more David-esque, and I think that's very much to the good.
Right. I mean, you cite in the piece, you know, at the New Republic, where Leon Wieseltier was out of control, and for some reason or other, this set of mores prevailed, as opposed to finding your inner Larry David and going, hey, look at that guy. He's out of control.
Right, exactly. And I think especially if you're a bystander to something, you know, be it sexual harassment or something else, often the impulse is to sort of say, well, you know, that's between them. It's weird. I don't want to make it uncomfortable for anyone. So people don't say things, you know, even though they've witnessed something. And, you know, there's the sort of countervailing ethic of see something, say something. And I think that too is getting a little bit more agency in this moment where, you know, the individual is empowered to speak up.
All right. So Megan Garber, great piece, The Weaponization of Awkwardness. Megan Garber reports on culture for The Atlantic, where that piece appeared. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that concludes our 1 hour exploration of awkwardness. Go out and be awkward in a really good way. And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Anything else I can help you with today, Ms. Wolf?
Nope. Just needed to change my address. But thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks for calling and have a great day.
You too. I love you. I didn't.
I love you too.